Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, a reminder that KABU is in the midst of our end-of-year pledge drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KABU has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free thanks to the support received from our members. So help us reach our $45,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. After the 2020 Labor Day wildfires, the Willamette National Forest planned a massive logging project along 400 miles of forest roads and several thousand acres under a loophole called a categorical exclusion. If allowed to proceed, the agency would have moved forward with large-scale logging operations without considering environmental impacts and without considering public feedback and involvement. But in early November, Federal District Judge Michael McShane stepped in and granted a preliminary injunction. This means that the Forest Service will be precluded from commencing logging until the court has heard and decided on the case, likely in early 2022. Today we talk again with Rebecca White, Wildlands Director for Cascadia Wildlands, about the significance of this ruling and how likely it is that this massive clear-cutting will be stopped. Rebecca, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having me, Barbara.
Well, let's bring the listeners up to speed, just to give some background about the clear-cutting that's been going on in all the national forests that are in the watersheds that burned in 2020. Let's just do a little background about what we were up against, and then we'll talk about this lawsuit that is so far looking very promising.
Great. Well, people have probably seen when they're driving around the state on our state highways that go up into the Cascades in areas that burned that there's been a lot of roadside logging. And a lot of that was carried out through Oregon Department of Transportation contracts with out-of-state contractors that did pretty heavy and probably excessive roadside logging in a lot of places. So folks probably saw that on state highways, but there's a sort of concurrent effort going on in our national forests and also in our federally owned Bureau of Land Management lands to do some roadside clearing work as well. Specifically in reference to the Willamette National Forest, this is our largest national forest in Oregon. It covers most of the western slope of the Cascades. So it runs from just north of Detroit, so sort of south of where the Mount Hood National Forest ends at the boundary of the northern boundary of the Willamette National Forest. You've got Detroit is there and Opal Creek Wilderness, and that's kind of the northern edge, and it stretches all the way south on the western slope of the Cascades. Just to where the Umpqua watershed starts, up above kind of like Timpanogos Lake and that area, and sort of south of Diamond Peak. And so the eastern boundary of the forest runs along the Cascade Crest and goes down the western slope of the Cascades down into the sort of mid-range foothills east of our cities like Salem and Eugene. So it's a huge forest, and we had, in 2020, in the Labor Day fires, we had three really big fires, the Beachy Creek, Lion's Head, and Holiday Farm fire. And as a result, large portions of the National Forest have been closed since the fires. So the Forest Service proposed to do this road reopening project early in 2020, following on the fires. And so it's what it's called is like a hazard tree removal project. And what it would entail is removing almost in a clear cut in many places, less so in many places, sort of a linear strip of trees up to 200 feet on either side of forest roads all throughout the Willamette National Forest. So the Forest Service looked at doing tree removal on something like 500 miles of roads and ultimately settled on 404 miles of roads that it wanted to do this roadside clearing project along. And so depending on the width of the buffer of trees that they would be cutting in order to sort of reopen the roads, that looks something like 15,000 to 20,000 acres. So we're talking a really large-scale project, sort of in the scheme of things as far as post-fire recovery work in Western Oregon.
And it wasn't just on the main roads. That was another one of the concerns that your group raised. Where were they planning on doing a lot of this logging?
Yeah, and I don't remember the exact number, but it was north of 300 of the miles of the roads were actually roads that were not even available for passenger car use. You need a high clearance vehicle to access those roads. And you have no expectation of sort of that your safety is assured when you take a road like that. And that's kind of on the Forest Service planning documents and maps and so forth. Those roads are not maintained for regular public access using passenger vehicles. So that was a huge portion of the roads, and another pretty sizable chunk of the roads that they wanted to reopen were roads that are administratively closed. So they sort of exist. Some of them have actually just sort of been converted into hiking trails. They're not even used by cars at all anymore, but they're closed to any sort of vehicle use, and they could potentially be reopened at some future point. But obviously no one from the public is going to be accessing roads that are completely closed. So that was a bit of a strange thing. And some of those were roads around the Opal Creek area and around Brighton Bush and so forth that people have been using as trails for a while and really didn't want the service to come in and do a big clear cut through.
What was their rationale for clear cutting or hazard tree logging these roads that are, the roads themselves are hazards to drive on?
Well, I think you just kind of hit on the point of it. There is no real rationale for that. And we had a tour with Forest Service leadership and staff to a couple of these closed roads pretty high up in the McKenzie watershed. And, you know, one of them was closed by boulders, a huge rock slide that had happened like 10 years ago. And the Forest Service has no intention of clearing this rock slide because it's a dead end road. It's a road to nowhere. And, you know, we said, well, clearly this is not a road that presents any hazard to public use. At most, a hiker might come through here, but certainly no one's driving a vehicle back here, you know. And they said, well, you know, we've got to do some commercial logging because we need to pay for other projects we need to do. And so it was a cost-benefit analysis in some ways. I mean, the Forest Service was pretty clear that they needed to be able to sell timber from this roadside clearing.
Well, ordinarily, when there's going to be a timber sale or clear cutting proposed in the National Forest, there's a whole procedure, like an environmental review that goes through. So why wasn't that happening in these cases?
Well, the Forest Service was trying to do two things, maybe even three things, trying to get some roads open, which I think we didn't oppose and certainly would encourage roads to recreation areas, to, you know, roads for public access to private lands, so forth. And they wanted to get some of that done before we had the first winter storms and maybe trees fell across the road and created more work down the line. The other piece is that the mills were really full this year of burned timber. And sometimes the mills were actually turning away log trucks that were showing up with burned timber from forest recovery, post-fire forest recovery. And so, you know, I think there was a little bit of a time crunch in the Forest Service thought process. Let's get some of the trees out before they decay to the point where the mills won't accept them. And then I think the third piece of it is the Forest Service didn't want to undergo this huge environmental review process and was going to see if it could sort of get by under what's called a categorical exclusion. We call it a CE, so we don't have to repeat categorical exclusion over and over again. So there's a CE that the Forest Service is allowed to use to sort of forego the normal NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, environmental review process. And those are intended for what we would think of as really small projects that couldn't possibly really be thought of to have any kind of environmental impact. And the classic examples are repairing a guardrail on a forest road, you know, repaving the parking lot at the visitor center, putting a new fence around the ranger station, that kind of thing. And so Forest Service for this project attempted to use what's called the D4 CE. It's for road maintenance. And the text of the CE itself gives examples of the kinds of things that are road maintenance. So one of them is repaving. One of them is replacing culverts. So these are clearly, one of them is like, I think, cutting brush from the side of the road, like brush that's overhanging the road or impacting the road in some way. But it's clearly not 20,000 acres of hazard tree removal, I think, in a logical sense. So, you know, but I think the Forest Service was hoping that it can be interpreted to mean that.
So how far did they get with these plans of just going ahead and cutting before your lawsuit slowed them down?
Well, they had the plans in place, and they had some of the initial contracts lined up to do some tree removal. It was actually scheduled to start on November 7th, and we had our preliminary injunction hearing in federal court on November 3rd, and a couple of days later, the judge issued that injunction to stop the logging before it started. So people are not confused, there are other hazard tree removal things that were happening in the Willamette National Forest and nearby lands as well. Like I said before, if it, state highways was involved, some of that would have been ODOT work. There were also trees that were removed during or right after the fires to maybe provide firefighter access or just post-fire sort of emergency time cleanup. But that was sort of a different thing. So some of that stuff that happened a little bit early on, there might have been some roads that were already cleared. But as far as this big forest-wide project, that was new, and that hadn't started yet.
So what happens now? You have the temporary injunction, but where do we go from here?
Well, the judge said that that the plaintiffs have a likelihood of winning the case on their merits. And so the plaintiffs in this case was Cascadia Wildlands, Oregon Wild, and Willamette River Keeper, and represented by the nonprofit Cragg Law Center out of Portland. And what that means is that the government is likely to maybe decide not to move forward with the project. And the judge was actually very clear in his written preliminary injunction ruling. He said, you know, the Forest Service has got to prepare an environmental analysis for this project. And the reason he was able to be so sort of clear-cut about that is that there's a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling from 2020 in the case EPIC versus Carlson. EPIC is an acronym for Environmental Protection Information Center, which is a small and really great, very effective Northern California grassroots environmental group that has gotten some really good case law in the books. And this was a case out of the Mendocino National Forest down in California, a smaller scale project than what the Willamette's trying to do, but a very similar sort of set of circumstances. After a large fire, this Forest Service wanted to clear maybe 100 miles of roads. And the case made it all the way to the Court of Appeals, who said this roadside maintenance CE, categorical exclusion, is just not appropriate for such a large-scale project. You've got to do environmental analysis. And the judge said, it's clear here in the Willamette National Forest, you're going to have to do an environmental analysis.
I'm wondering why the Forest Service thought they could get away without doing this environmental analysis.
Well, maybe they thought we wouldn't sue.
I should know better than that.
We've actually been asking ourselves that question quite a bit, because we, in our initial comments to the agency, written comments, meetings we had with agency leadership, tours in the field, you know, we kind of said that over and over again. You know, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has really clearly said that you can't use this exclusion to get out of doing environmental analysis for a project that big. And I think maybe they just thought they would see if they could.
Well, how much damage has been done before this injunction happened? Or was the damage that was already done a totally separate issue?
You know, a lot of it probably was a totally separate issue. There's a whole kind of gray area around what happens during emergency authorizations during and after a fire. So a lot of things can happen during a fire emergency time that kind of can't happen during the normal course of events. And that can look like things that firefighters do to try to prevent the spread of fire, like cutting down a bunch of trees and putting in bulldozer lines and carving open roads that have been closed to protect resources, that kind of thing. And that's all sort of done in the heat of the moment and is deemed necessary by the incident command team. So that's the sort of thing that maybe there's damage involved, but maybe it was necessary to prevent, you know, fires from spreading to certain areas. So as far as ongoing logging in the sort of non-emergency course of events, a whole lot of damage hasn't actually been done on the Willamette in this case. So there is some other salvage logging going on the Willamette too, and you may have seen in the news there were some protesters that some citizen activists that went up to the Brighton Bush area along Highway 46 and closed the road to block some logging access up there. And that's in reference to another lawsuit that we're involved in with Oregon Wild, and also represented by Cragg Law Center there. So that one's in federal court, and that case is due to be heard for a preliminary injunction hearing this week as well. So we'll know more about that one too. But that logging has already started there.
We'll talk more about that on the next time we talk with you. You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Rebecca White, who's the Wildlands Director for Cascadia Wildlands, about a recent injunction to halt post-fire clear-cutting in the Willamette National Forest. And I want to remind you that now is also a good time to become a member of KBOO during our end-of-the-year pledge drive. KBOO receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of listeners are members. So help increase our member ratio by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to kboo.fm, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, I wanted to sort of get a sense of where all of this stands in terms of how much of the cutting that we've been hearing about and been feeling maybe a little panicked about, how much of it is under litigation and how much of it is just a done deal?
Well, it kind of depends on the land ownership you're talking about. So a lot of land in Oregon in the Cascades that burned is privately owned industrial timberland. Most of that is that was burned has already been salvaged, logged off, and maybe some of it's even, they've even started replanting in some cases. So that's a done deal. And so if people are driving around through the foothills or hiking around and they see, you know, big, large scale, we're talking, you know, over 100, 200 acre clear cuts in a burn, that's most likely going to be private land. As far as the federal land, a lot of that hasn't gotten started yet. There are two big projects on Bureau of Land Management. One in the Archie Creek fire footprint in the Umpqua area, and then one in the Holiday Farm fire footprint in the McKenzie area. And those are both under litigation, although some logging has started in those. And the Willamette National Forest, some logging has started, like I told you, in the Highway 46 area. There was a timber sale there that Oregon Wild and Cascadia Wildlands and others, community members, spent a long time working with the Forest Service several years ago before the fire to make those plans sort of less damaging. Some units were dropped because they had habitat for critters like the red treevil, northern spotted owl. Other units were converted from clear cut to just a restoration thinning. And then it was discovered by some ground truthing volunteers that after the fire, that the Forest Service was clear cutting those areas that were supposed to be thinned and had changed the contracts without telling anyone. So that's the case where there's going to be a preliminary injunction hearing this week. So that logging is ongoing, and we're just hoping to stop more of it. And then if folks are further north, thinking of Mount Hood National Forest, there is a project there, and I know your listeners have heard about this from Michael Crockett that you had on a few weeks ago, too. There is a project up there to do some roadside hazard tree removal, too, but they've agreed to scale that back for now and do more environmental analysis.
So what's the prognosis now for the first lawsuit that we're talking about that has the injunction?
Well, I think it's pretty good. The court's ruling was really unequivocal. And the judge more or less ordered the Forest Service to do an environmental analysis on this. And the way that he worded the injunction order was that the Forest Service may not proceed with any commercial logging as a result of post-fire logging in the Willamette National Forest until an environmental analysis is prepared. So that's a multi-month, maybe over a year-long process. So that's all on hold for now. And we asked the judge for this as well. We asked if the judge would issue his ruling in such a way that the Forest Service could go in now and remove trees that actually are hazardous. So there's several classifications of hazard trees that we don't need to get into, but trees that are imminently hazardous, which means they have a really high chance of falling within the next year, and it wouldn't take much to knock them over. They're really, really rotted out, really burned up, and they're near a road. They could actually hit a road. The Forest Service can go in and remove those, but according to the judge, they may not sell those trees. So there's no commercial logging potential from that whatsoever. They just have to leave the trees lying in the forest there.
Which is a good place for them because they could probably do a lot of good lying in the forest.
Yeah, they'll help soak up water. They'll help stop silt from flowing down into the rivers. They'll provide habitat for new seedlings and for little critters that like to burrow in rotten wood. It'll be great.
If there's going to be like over a year wait before any logging could begin, is there a possibility by that time that the trees will not be commercially viable anymore and there'd be no motivation for doing commercial logging?
Yeah, I think opinions vary on that. Probably with the smaller trees, that's the case. Smaller diameter trees, larger diameter trees, maybe 20 inches and over, can stand a long time. And especially some of the lighter burn trees that the Forest Service might want to remove at some point will retain their value for quite a while, and or may recover. There are trees sometimes that look dead after a fire that start to flush out the next year with new leaves. So, the argument that all the timber is going to decay and that there's, you know, no value to be gotten from it is only partly true, I would say.
Once the environmental review is done, do you think there's a good chance that this logging might actually be stopped for good?
I think that it'll be scaled way back. My hope that the Forest Service will come back with a really common sense proposal. For example, won't try to log these, you know, several hundred miles of roads that are only accessible to high clearance vehicles and that the public hardly ever uses. I hope that they would sort of go back to what we asked for from the beginning, which is to scale it way back to roads that people actually use, just take out the trees that could actually fall on people, and, you know, do an environmental review to make sure everybody's aware of all the impacts and help you decide which ones are the highest priority. And just stick with that. And my sense is that would be a much, much smaller proposal, maybe 100 miles of roads or way less, perhaps. Yeah, because we did, you know, I think one of the sort of talking points of our opponents or the timber industry around this case has been something like, environmentalists want to prevent people from getting out into their forest and enjoying it. They're trying to stop the Forest Service from opening roads. And boy, this is going to be a real hardship on people that now can't get out into the forest because the environmentalists won this lawsuit. But if you really look at the facts of the case, it's not that at all, because more than 3/4 of the roads are totally unusable by the public at this point anyway. So it's not as if these are roads that people were accessing.
Another part of it is that if the Forest Service got away with all this logging, would people want to be going and enjoying recreation in these areas that are basically clear cuts?
Yeah, I think less so. We heard from folks in the Detroit area and other places up in the Santiam Canyon, where some pretty heavy post-fire logging was carried out by Oregon Department of Forestry on the Santiam State Forest, which burned. And we heard from people that it was actually more traumatic to see the forest around their homes logged than the fire itself was for them. And of course, mileage may vary on those emotions. Everyone has a different reaction to the fire, and it was a loss of life and loss of homes and properties, devastating. But I think that going out into a burn landscape that's been logged is a pretty depressing experience. Going out into a burn landscape that's recovering naturally is actually kind of beautiful. And if folks, you know, want to go around and explore different areas, of course, where the Eagle Creek fire burned is recovering beautifully. For something that's a little bit further along, the Cascade Crest up at Santiam Pass, where the B&B fire burned maybe 18 years ago, is recovering gorgeous. It's full of butterflies and wildflowers and all kinds of songbirds. So definitely a place that has not been logged after a fire is a beautiful place to visit.
Well, it's not just fires where I think they go and do some devastating post work, but also maybe windstorms. I was at Herman Creek, well, I guess it was early last spring, and it was after the big windstorm last winter. And I had been there since the fire, and it had been really beautiful. And in fact, I saw these rock formations I'd never seen before because there were too many trees in the way. But when I went there this time, well, actually, the road was closed. You had to park down by the freeway. And we got up there, and what had been the parking lot and this campground was just devastated. And there were a lot of down trees that looked like they had been cut down. They weren't just windfall. And it looked like a moonscape. And I have not been able to find out what went on there. But it seems to me that the motivation to go in and get windfall or post-fire logging or whatever really is at the expense of the beauty and the integrity of the woods themselves.
I think so, too. And I think the windfall, you know, like we talked about before, it provides these little, all downed wood in general, provides these little microhabitats and microclimates where all kinds of different creatures and plants and fungi can grow after a fire. And it's great for water storage. It helps to hold the the water from rainfall and snowmelt high up in the watershed instead of having it rush downstream in floods. So these are all really beneficial things. And as long as, you know, we're able to get in there and clear trails and stuff so people can still enjoy their recreation and be safe, I think that's really all that needs to be done, you know. Definitely these massive sort of over enthusiastic clearings are not what the public wants in general and are not ecologically indicated by any means, and are not really indicated for safety in most cases either. So
one of the concerns I have is from hearing stories from people who've been and actually looked at the logging, like Dan Sears, who spent a bunch of time sneaking into the Clackamas River area and just seeing really devastating scenes, and concerns that the logging is just going to transform these forests into kind of wastelands, actually. I just wonder your sense of how much of that has happened on the landscape and how large a percentage is still remaining for your lawsuits to protect.
Well, as far as the actual acreage of what burned, you know, we know that something like 1 million acres of Western Oregon forest burned west of the Cascades in 2020. And, you know, for all of the sort of pain of seeing these places logged, much of the land managed by the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service is wilderness or has other protective designations, such as late successional reserve and so forth, and it cannot be salvage logged for any reason. So a lot of public land is actually off limits from post-fire salvage logging. And I don't know what the total is, but it's a lot. It's probably a majority. So people can feel good about that. Those areas are going to recover naturally. And a lot of, you know, the fires tend to start high up in the Cascade Crest. So those are almost all wilderness areas. So those areas that burned will recover naturally, and they'll be beautiful again in just a few years. Young new forests. And then as far as private land, a lot of that is done. And I don't know what the percentage of the 1 million acres that burned is private land, but it was going to be clear cut logged anyway. So
Tim Inglesby was telling me he hadn't been down to the Holiday Farm fire at that time. This was like, we're talking in September of 2020. But he was under the impression that, I mean, there was a lot of industrial forest there. And he expected that those were the ones that burnt the hardest, that the natural forests are a lot more resilient. And I wonder if any of that has been proven.
There was a study that came out. I think the author's name is Alexander Harris, although I could double check that. And it was just published earlier this year in a did a really good survey of land ownerships and burn patterns in the Holiday Farm fire. And it absolutely bore out that statement. The fire burned hotter and faster and more intensely in the industrial timberlands. And if you think about it, it's pretty commonsensical. You know, fires don't move very quickly through moist, old Douglas fir stands that have a lot of moisture in the ground and old rotting logs that are wet and lots of shade to keep the ground cool. Fires move very fast and very hot through young tree plantations where all the trees are the same size. There's hardly any shade on the ground. Everything's very dried out because the wind is moving through very fast and very hot. And all the trees are sort of touching each other. You know, it's just, it makes intuitive sense, but it's actually been shown that that is the case too. And in the Holiday Farm fire footprint, the majority of lands, I believe, were under public industrial timberland ownership.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Rebecca White, who's the Wildlands Director for Cascadia Wildlands, about a recent injunction to halt post-fire clear-cutting in the Willamette National Forest. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our end-of-year pledge drive. KBOO is 52 years old and one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland. So please support this vital community institution by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to kboo.fm, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. And I will say that I think that KBOO has done some of the best coverage of the logging concerns, the clear-cutting concerns in the wake of the fire last year, but in the wake of lots of fires and lots of forest issues. Our coverage goes back not quite 52 years, because we didn't have a news department back then, but definitely back to the 80s. So if you're enjoying this conversation that I'm having right now with Rebecca White, just remember that you're not going to hear a conversation like this anyplace else on the Portland airwaves. So thanks for joining us again today, Rebecca, to help us prove why KBOO is special.
Thanks so much. It's definitely special. I'm definitely going to KBOO.fm right after this to give my donation for the year.
Thank you. Last thing I want to talk about is just a sense of where all these potential lawsuits are going. I want to talk a little bit more about what's going on around the Brighton Bush area, because that was the first place a lot of us heard had been logged. And it was devastating to the homeowners there and then to everybody who loves Brighton Bush. So what's happening there? And then I also want to talk about some of the other controversies that are happening further south in the Willamette National Forest.
Okay. Well, as you kind of referred to there, one of the first things we heard about too in the conservation community was some post-fire logging around the cabins up in the Brighton Bush area. And the Forest Service came in and took down what they were calling hazard trees that burned in the fire. And they were huge diameter old growth trees. And of course had been extremely valued by the folks who had the summer cabins up there. And folks were very upset because maybe it wasn't really well indicated those were in fact hazard trees. And I think it was probably Forest Service using an abundance of caution, overabundance of caution, to remove such big trees that probably would have stood. You know, this is one interesting fact that I recently learned, but trees that burn, especially bigger trees, even if they die in a fire, they often remain standing for decades. So, you know, it's not as if big old trees that burn are typically are safety hazards at all. So that was the first sort of glimmer of what was to come, with the agencies moving really fast after the fires and sort of without giving a lot of public notice to what they were planning. And then the next sort of big wave of logging that was pretty concerning for folks was a lot of the highway clearing along, like you said before, the Clackamas River was one of the first ones with really extensive roadside clearing by ODOT. Again, trees that probably weren't really hazard trees, really big, really old trees right along the river there. And this happened in all the watersheds that burned. So you can, you know, you're talking all the way from the Clackamas, the Santiam, the Mackenzie, and down even into the Umpqua too, because the big Archie Creek fire burned down through there.
How many lawsuits are going on? Because there's the one up around Brighton Bush, which you've talked about. Are there others that are happening further south?
There's a similar lawsuit that's pending on the Umpqua National Forest, and that's a smaller scale project, maybe 65 or maybe 100 miles, I don't remember the exact number, to clear under this same roadside maintenance categorical exclusion without doing environmental analysis, some hazard tree removal down there. And that's in a sort of similar position. It hasn't had a preliminary injunction hearing yet, and so I think there's probably talks going on to see whether that lawsuit is going to need to move forward or whether the Forest Service is going to adhere to the court's ruling in the Willamette National Forest case. And then there is another lawsuit pending with a similar group of plaintiffs here, Cascadia Wildlands, Oregon Wild, and others, about some larger scale salvage post-fire logging up the Mackenzie watershed that the Bureau of Land Management is carrying out. And they're attempting to do that under a different categorical exclusion for salvage sale, post-fire salvage sales. So that lawsuit is pending as well, and we don't have a ruling in that one yet.
So is the logging already going on in these
places? That one is. Yeah, they've definitely sold some of the timber units, and some operators have gotten up there, although they may have to slow down because we've gotten a lot of rain up here recently.
So how optimistic are you that you are going to prevail and that the rest of this logging won't happen?
Pretty optimistic. We have strong cases in all of these lawsuits, and it's more just sort of the ticking of the slow process of justice. You know, it just takes a little time for a lawsuit to move through the courts, and so you know, we're waiting for rulings here and there. We've got hearings here and there, so. I think we feel pretty good about our case in the Brighton Bush area, and look forward to having some good news, hopefully, to report on that in the next month or so. And hopefully we'll hear some good news out of the Umpqua National Forest, too. So as far as the logging that is planned or ongoing on our national forests. I think things look pretty good, actually.
Great. Well, let's check in again in a couple months and see how things are going. It's great to talk with you, Rebecca. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Likewise. Thank you.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria and Radio Tacoma. And today we've been talking with Rebecca White, Wildlands Director for Cascadia Wildlands, about a recent injunction to halt post-fire clear-cutting in the Willamette National Forest. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our end-of-the-year pledge drive. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and people like you. Join now. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to kboo.fm, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. And now to some breaking news. At least it was breaking when we recorded this show last Thursday. On December 1st, after 17 years of community organizing, the Jordan Cove LNG Export Terminal and Frack Gas Pipeline Project was announced officially dead. Pembina, the latest company to sponsor this project, announced that it decided not to move forward with the project and asked the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to cancel its permit. When I heard this news, I immediately got in touch with my contacts in Southern Oregon, who were suspended between states of numbness and celebration. For the rest of this hour, we're going to talk with Allie Rosenbluth, Campaigns Director with Rogue Climate in Phoenix, Oregon, about what this amazing news means to the folks who have devoted most of their lives for the past 5 to 17 years working to stop this project from being built. Allie, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, first of all, congratulations on a job well done. Mission accomplished. Let's talk about what the events on December 1st mean to you and to the community that you work with.
Yeah. So on December 1st, we got incredible news that the company was done with Jordan Cove LNG. And it is so exciting. And after 15 years and thousands of people and so much time and resources and energy, it just feels like the most exciting win and the most exciting end to this over 15-year long saga. So I'm so excited, and personally I feel just so happy for all of the friends that I have made along the pipeline route who are no longer threatened by this project, whether it's impacted landowners or impacted tribal members or folks whose drinking water would be impacted by the project. So excited that the salmon and the water are safe and people aren't living under this threat anymore, and that our climate is protected from this monster of a project. It's just so exciting and feels really good, I think, for a lot of people down here this week.
Well, for people who are just tuning into reality, maybe we should just run by a little bit of what this project would have meant to Southern Oregon, what it comprised of, and what the impacts would have been.
Pembina, a Canadian fossil fuel corporation, was proposing to build a 225-mile-long frack gas pipeline through Klamath, Jackson, Douglas, and Coos County to a proposed liquefied natural gas export terminal on the Port of Coos Bay. Along the way of the pipeline route, the construction would have harmed hundreds of waterways, thousands of people's public drinking water and wells, create a permanent clear cut throughout the state of Oregon, and be a major fire risk, putting explosive frack gas in Oregon's very wildfire-prone Southern Oregon. On top of that, the export terminal just on its own would have become the largest source of climate pollution in the state of Oregon, making it impossible for the state to ever reach its climate goals. It also posed a huge safety risk to thousands in Coos Bay and North Bend and Charleston who were in the hazardous burn zone, and would have had a really big impact on the fishing community and so many people all across the region. So there have been so many people who have spoken out against this project, whether it's by writing comments to state and federal agencies, by showing up to rallies and hearings, by writing letters to the editor in their communities, from Klamath, California to Portland, Oregon. And every single one of those people who've taken action to stop Jordan Cove is part of this victory. And we could definitely not have done it without every single person speaking out and putting pressure on the state to deny those permits and keeping that pressure up until this project was dead for good.
I'm thinking about just how long it's taken. And I had this memory back in 2016 when my friend Carol Newman was on the radio at KMUN in Astoria, and she suddenly got word that Oregon LNG had bit the dust and that they had basically given up their permit for building this huge LNG plant that was going to be at the mouth of the Columbia River in Warrenton. And this is after another very large LNG export terminal was also canceled. And I just remember the emotion in her voice as she announces this on her music show on KMUN. And she keeps saying, 12 years of our lives, 12 years of our lives. And that project started at the same time that Jordan Cove started. It's not just 12 years, it's five more years than that. And I just wonder what kind of impact that's having on people. I talked with Larry Mangan, who's one of the landowners who would have been impacted by the pipeline. He said to me yesterday, well, he's really happy, but he's also numb. And he talked about people going through post-traumatic stress. I'm wondering what you're hearing from people down there who would have been so impacted by Jordan Cove LNG.
Yeah, this has been a long and tough fight, and people have put so much of themselves into protecting their homes and protecting our communities. And that has an impact on our bodies and our minds. Because we were able to work together and we were able to find common ground and like build power as communities, not focus it on one individual who had to hold everything to stop Jordan Cove, I think we were able to win. And I think people deserve a break, especially people feeling really tired after, 17 years of fighting Jordan Cove and now a pandemic and wildfires and everything else that's happening in the world right now. But also, I think all of these people are really incredible leaders in their communities now and know what it takes to win something. And I think we can now apply that to what is the Southern Oregon and the Oregon South Coast that we want to see. What do good jobs look like for our community members? What does just renewable energy development look like in our communities? And how do we ensure that like energy is affordable for folks in rural Oregon while we're taking action on climate? So there is so much to build from stopping Jordan Cove LNG. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't take a break. You know, if you are feeling overwhelmed like or numb, I think it's really important that we listen to our bodies here. But also, the work's not done. We have a lot to fight for the world we need to build.
One of the things that keeps crossing my mind is how much energy and time these fights against fossil fuel have taken for your community, for Tacoma, which is still fighting against LNG there, for Kalama, which had a great victory just a few months ago. What do you feel about being released from having to fight something and maybe be able to start working towards trying to build something?
Yeah. Rogue Climate, we've been trying to do both for the past couple of years. And I think we are really excited that we will have a little bit more energy to put towards the building of the world we want to see. But we've been doing it, right? We passed the 100% Clean Energy for All bill. We passed the Energy Affordability Bill. And we're going to keep doing that work. We're going to keep, you know, supporting fire survivors. And we're going to, you know, build out. How do we protect the Coos Bay Estuary? How do we transition Coos County and the Rogue Valley to clean and just energy? And so that's really exciting. And it's exciting to continue that work and exciting to figure out like what that work looks like when Jordan Cove like isn't constantly in the background. But at the same time, we know we have to remain vigilant. We know that the fossil fuel industry has had its eyes on Southern Oregon for almost 2 decades now, and we need to make sure that if a new project is proposed, whether it's exactly the same as Jordan Cove LNG or a little bit different, that our communities are still ready to fight back against fossil fuels, and that our communities are ready to, you know, take on fossil fuels in their own homes too. What are we doing about natural gas in our cities? There's a lot of important work to be done, and a lot of it is happening. And it's exciting to think about what it can look like without Jordan Cove constantly in the shadows.
One of the things about these fossil fuel fights is that they bring people together who might never have come together before. Larry was saying to me yesterday on the phone how he appreciates having all these new friends, that and that kind of struggle that you've all been in brings you really closely together. How do you use these friendships to move ahead into this world, both of building new things and also being vigilant about the same old enemies trying to knock on your door?
Totally. And I don't think it's about using our friendships, right? It's about knowing what we share in common and what we want to build in our communities. And I know there's a ton of alignment, you know, whether people are, you know, more on the conservative or liberal side of things. There's a lot of alignment on wanting our communities to be strong and self-sufficient. And knowing that clean energy is a really big part in that. So I think what's, you know, going to happen next is we're, you know, going to work towards what we always wanted to see, right? Whenever we were saying stop Jordan Cove, we were also saying, but yes, we do want good, stable jobs for people in our community. And we want to see that in industries that don't harm the bay and don't harm our climate and don't harm cultural natural resources of the tribes. And so now we get to figure out what those look like and we get to make them happen. And because people have put so much time and energy and thought into this project, they know what those jobs can look like. That is somewhere in their minds. And now we're doing the work of figuring it out and like collaborating together to see what's next and what we can build.
Well, in the reporting work that I've done around Jordan Cove LNG, I've met some really incredible people. And I wanted to acknowledge who some of these people are. And maybe we can start with Jody McCaffrey, who was one of the first people to get engaged in this fight. And just mention, let's talk about who these people are, where they came from, and the kind of work that they did.
Yeah, there's countless people. Jody and Larry, you've already mentioned. And, you know, I could name 1,000 other people who've been a part of this fight. And I think what's so special is that everybody comes to it from a different angle. And everybody was prioritizing a, like, different reason why they wanted to stop this project, but we all saw the value in what each other was bringing. And I think that was why this campaign has been a success. We weren't set up to win being a rural, low-income community crossing through a lot of indigenous lands. There are, you know, pipeline projects being built right now that communities were probably better set up to stop than we were. And somehow we did it, and that's miraculous. And, you know, while we think about the work that needs to be done in Southern Oregon to build strong communities, we also need to think about what are the other pipelines that are continuing to happen. I'm thinking about the Coastal GasLink pipeline and Wet'suwet'en land. I'm thinking about Line 3 and Anishinaabe land, and how those fights are still happening, and how can we continue to raise the leadership from the indigenous communities fighting those projects and be in solidarity with them, and hopefully be able to support them in stopping and shutting down those projects for good.
Well, I remember the first time that I interviewed you, you talked about how you kind of cut your teeth fighting an LNG facility in Maryland, I believe, back when you were in college, and that campaign did not succeed. And then you said this statement that you put in a funny way where you said that you were so glad that here you were in Southern Oregon and you could fight another LNG facility.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what I meant, but it felt kind of serendipitous, right, that there was this opportunity to continue that work and be able to push back in this industry that I had already seen harm a whole bunch of people. So it's really exciting that in Southern Oregon, we were able to come to such a success. And my heart also like still breaks for all of the communities that didn't have this luck. Also, like, firmly believe that those projects can be shut down, and that we, as folks who have had this experience stopping Jordan Cove LNG, need to continue, like, showing up for communities who we know where they've been at, you know, like, we know what it feels like. I think continuing to show up and not just, like, being like, okay, that pipeline in my community is done. I'm not thinking about the other ones. I think it's really important that we continue to speak out against all of the different fossil fuel infrastructure projects that are currently being built.
What in particular do you feel you have to offer to other communities that are fighting similar battles? What do you feel like you really learned in particular from fighting Jordan Cove LNG?
I think that the most important thing is building really deep relationships across the many different opinions that people have, and not letting what people disagree on, like, get in the way of really honing in what we agree on. I think that really, like, the huge reason why Jordan Cove LNG was able to be stopped is because there's an incredible family of people that was built to stop it, and that we were able to support each other. And when things felt hard, and people felt numb, or people had to take breaks because different things were happening in their lives that they had to prioritize, there were more people to show up and to have their backs and to step in and to, like, share this experience together and to know that you're not alone in it. So building that community is just so key. And then I think just, like, having a really clear strategy and some incredible attorneys that will back you up in that strategy, who value the work of organizing, I think is super key as well. And I think also at the same time, like, I know so many places where they had all of this, they had all of that magic sauce, but the fossil fuel industry is still winning and these pipelines are still happening. And that's because the system is so broken. It's not set up for people to win. It's set up for fossil fuel corporations to move forward their projects. So we also have to remember that and, like, not feel shamed or any community is doing something wrong in fighting these projects. It is not an easy thing to do, but it is possible. And when we really focus in on our relationships and our organizing and have it backed up with all the legal expertise that we need, we can win. And that's exciting.
One of the biggest challenges that I'm feeling right now in any kind of struggle is that it sort of feels like our society's falling apart in the wake of the pandemic, in the wake of the post-Trump era, all the hatred that has just become so visceral and so out front, and the violence. And actually, Larry was talking about people carrying guns along the waterfront in Coos Bay right now. And it just, there's a lot of tension that is, I think, much more amplified than it was when I was down in Coos Bay 2 years ago, before the pandemic. And I wonder how you see that this win against Jordan Cove LNG maybe can offer some alternative to the kind of violence and division that we're experiencing across the country and actually across the world right
now.
Yeah,
I hope so. I really hope that stopping Jordan Cove LNG can have that impact. I think at the very least, it is that, like, glimmer of good news in a two-year stretch that has been extremely hard and challenging for everybody. And I think also, I hope that people take out of this win that even though people are different and have different opinions, doesn't mean that we sometimes can't work together. And there's, like, real power when we can figure out what we can work together on. And that is something that's really beautiful and something that is even harder to make happen with the pandemic and all of the tension that is happening in Southern Oregon and all across the world. I also hope, too, that people have learned from this, especially white folks, white settlers like myself, in Southern Oregon and across Oregon, have learned a lot more about the tribes and the peoples whose lands they occupy, and that through this campaign, they've learned to be in better relationship with the indigenous peoples of these lands and will support efforts led by these tribes and these indigenous communities all across Southern Oregon and Northern California who worked with people to stop this pipeline. And I hope that stopping Jordan Cove LNG and this work, this campaign, will make this region stronger advocates for Indigenous sovereignty and hopefully returning land to its rightful holders.
Well, Ali, I'm really glad to be able to share this moment of joy with you in celebration within 24 hours of the news that broke yesterday. And next week on Locus Focus, we'll talk more. We'll spend the whole hour talking with you and hopefully Deb Evans and a representative from the Klamath Tribes and get a broader perspective. And maybe we can do a whole kind of lessons learned survey of what you all learned and where you want to go forward from this incredible experience.
Totally.
So thanks for being on Locus Focus.
That sounds fun. Thank you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Ali Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us during our end-of-year pledge drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community radio station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with some music by Joni Mitchell and Willie Nelson. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots or your booster, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.